Welcome everyone. We're in a session on changes in ALM under LAGIC. So if that's not the topic you're expecting to hear, you'd probably better go somewhere else. We have a presentation today by Jared Callahan and Peter Baker from Deloitte. Jared is a director in the Deloitte practice and is a life insurance specialist, and Peter is an associate director also in the life insurance practice. And they'll do the presentation, Jared will introduce, and they'll hand forward between themselves. And at the end, we should have time for questions. This session is being recorded. When we get round to questions, if people can please speak, go to the microphone and speak clearly and identify themselves before they ask their question. Anyway, without further ado, here's Jared.
Thanks, Richard. So today we're really covering a topic which we could probably spend most of the day talking about. So we've selected a few key things and examples to show you just to sort of illustrate how things might have changed, so going from the old world to the new. So we'll really cover three things. We'll start off with what the impact of LAGIC has been on life insurer capital, more focusing on the volatility of it rather than the overall quantum. We'll also do a summary of what LAGIC actually comprises of to give the background context. We'll then move into the choices insurers can make given the volatility of the new requirements. Do they stay with the do they accept and set target surplus or a buffer to cope with the volatility, or do they indeed implement more hedging or different changes which we'll talk about to reduce the volatility? So those are really the three things we'll talk about, and at the end we'll sort of wrap up and give our views on potentially where further change might come from where we are at the moment. So with that, I'll hand over to Peter just to cover the first few sections.
Yeah, thanks. So thanks for coming along today. I thought before we started it might be useful to have a bit of an overview of, the new capital requirements, particularly for those who are not as familiar with what's happened recently. So last year it was the start of the new regulation for life insurance and general insurance. For life insurance, it was quite a big change compared to the GI industry, which was already, we almost, in the life insurance industry, aligned much more with the GI industry in terms of the structure of the capital requirements. So to briefly go through, though, the way that the new capital standards work, it's much more risk-based than the previous standards. So previously, you had essentially two scenarios, a runoff scenario for solvency capital, and then a going concern 3-year calculation for your CAPAD, and you took the maximum of the two as a capital. Now you've got one single calculation for capital made up of different risks or charges that address various risks. So the four key risks that are being addressed are the insurance risk, which is mortality, morbidity, lapse risk, that type of thing. You've got asset risk, which is essentially like an asset liability mismatch charge. There's an operational risk charge, which is a very simple formula-based approach based on the size and the speed of which you grow your business. And there's an asset concentration risk, which is really counterparty risk. Have you got big exposures to particular counterparties? Then on top of that, there's a bunch of different adjustments that you need to make and allowances for aggregation, diversification, and other pieces of capital that you can allow for. So some of the key changes, though, from here versus the previous standards are that some of the asset risk charges are stronger than under the previous standards. There is, though, explicit allowance for diversification benefits, which, yes, there were some under the previous standards, but not as much as exists now. And there are also, I guess, for some of the insurance risks, some changes in the stresses that are allowable. So depending on where you sat under the old, I guess, margins that you're allowed to apply for the solvency and the CAPAB standards, you could find that under the new standards you had a higher or lower or similar capital requirement. So this is, I guess, the structure of what the new standards go through, and that, as you can see, it's structured around the risks. As a result, I think because of the way that the new standards are, presented, you need to stress separately your assets and your liabilities. You explicitly stress both sides of your balance sheet when you do these capital calculations. I think what this has resulted in is more volatility in the actual capital requirement at the end of the day, and essentially the amount of excess assets you have above your capital requirement. So some of the areas where volatility has increased have been due to the fact that there are larger stresses now. You do explicitly stress a few additional aspects to what you previously do, such as CPI, which was half dealt with in the previous standards. There's a new separate infrastructure stress, which separates it out from equities, and there's an illiquidity premium for things such as annuities. Of course, countering that are things like the diversification benefit, which are now explicitly allowed, and that smooths out some of that volatility. But what we've seen in some of our calculations, we essentially created a model to look at the capital projections historically over time under a variety of different scenarios and under the old and the new capital standards. And so we've pulled out a couple of examples here which show the increased volatility of the new capital standards. So these graphs also show that there's an increase in capital, but that's not necessarily the case across all different asset allocations. So, some have actually reductions in capital versus the old standards, and some are very similar. So we just happen to have pulled out two which have higher capital standards. But what we wanted to focus on is not the absolute amount here, but rather the volatility. So for the reasons that I've talked about, there's much more volatility over time. So the question is, how are companies going to deal with this volatility? The two examples that we've shown on this slide, the first one on the bottom left is about an annuity book. So we backed it with fixed interest assets, some corporate bonds, and also a little bit of equities, and tossing in the illiquidity premium as well. It results in a relatively volatile movement compared to the previous standards. So the green line at the top is the new one versus the old one, which is the blue line at the bottom. We've also pulled out a risk book, which is 100% backed fixed interest, and again you see the same issues with that. So the question, I guess, really is, what are we going to do with we're seeing this extra volatility in the capital, and we need to understand how to deal with that. So Gerard, before we move on to answer that question, is going to talk a little bit about some of the other issues that that also increase volatility in the new capital standards.
Thanks, Pete. So Pete's talked about how the standards actually determine your capital requirement and how volatile that is. But there can be certain risks which the standards and capital calculations don't actually fully pick up. And I just want to talk through one example which was quite topical overseas in the last couple of years, and that's the idea of the basis risk between discount rates on your liabilities and how your hedges or assets are actually priced by the investment banks and by the market. And I call this a new risk, but it isn't really a new risk. It's something that's always been there. but it's one that came to the fore, certainly in the UK, through the GFC. So under Solvency II, for example, you discount your liabilities using swap rates rather than government bond rates. You discount those using swap rates. So wherever you use swaps to hedge those liabilities, the pricing rate, the rate at which you discount the cash flows on the swap hedges, used to be swap rate based as well. But in the last couple of years, most of the big investment banks moved towards a different set of rates, sort of called SONIA, more overnight based rates rather than swap rates. And historically, SONIA and LIBOR or swap rates were very, very close to each other. Interest, they weren't very far apart at all. But during the GFC, those two rates moved apart quite significantly. And so what you had was liability movements which weren't quite matched by so-called perfect hedges. And there was a mismatch there, and the Solvency II standards, in a similar way to the LAGIC standards, don't really pick up that basis risk that could exist. Because traditionally it has been pretty small, but has, in this example, grown quite bigger in sort of liquidity stress situations. So the question I've been asking is sort of, could something similar happen in Australia? There are liabilities under the new standards discounted using Commonwealth government bond yields, and we still have a situation where we might hedge with interest rate swaps or inflation swaps, which will have a different discount rate, some type of overnight index rate, potentially. And indeed, the cash flows on those swaps are based on swap rates again, if you're talking about interest rates. So there is this natural basis risk that exists, even though that's not an explicit stress that's required under the standards. So going to the next slide, this just illustrates what happened during the GFC with SONIA, the rate at which swaps are priced, and LIBOR, which is the discount rate under Solvency II. So, I mean, pre-crisis, the rates were pretty much identical. I haven't put a graph up there, but they pretty much sat adjacent to each other, barely a basis point difference. Then in sort of 2008, the curves really moved apart quite materially, sort of up to 100 basis points at the short end and sort of, you know, 60 basis points sort of at the mid-rate. Mid sort of term there. So they moved apart and then came back together more recently. So that basis risk materialized during the crisis and then slowly moved away. This situation didn't actually cause any companies to run out of capital or anything like that, but companies did notice this mismatching. So if you're a company that's quite close to the edge in terms of capital requirements, this kind of thing can be a real risk for you. So looking at Australia and how swap spreads have moved in the last few years and versus Commonwealth bond yields. So on here, if you can see it clearly, the green line there are sort of how swaps have the swap yield. The blue line is the government bond yield. And the red line indicates how the spreads have been moving. So like I say, liabilities discounted Commonwealth government bond, your swap and inflation hedges will be more based on the swap curve. So this difference, the red line spiking up in 2008 during the GFC and to not so big an extent in 2012, would have meant that the hedges didn't quite move in line with how the liabilities might have moved during those historical years. They probably are doing very well at the moment, but historically they may not have been. So it's quite an interesting analysis, and you see the same dynamic on the fifth, five-year and 10-year points on the curve. I keep getting the button the wrong way around. So you get volatility from two sources. One is how the standards pick up risks and how they move over the time, because the standards are dependent on current market conditions, as Peter's explained. And the other is these other risks that exist that are not quite picked up. So you have a choice. Do you accept the current level of volatility you see in the portfolio? It's within the risk appetite of the business. We're happy with that level of volatility, and we can set an appropriate target surplus to handle it. That's one approach. The other approach is to say, well, I'm not happy with that. It's outside of the risk appetite that I've set for the business. I want to reduce that by changing certain things. Or do you do a bit of both of those? So the first one we'll look at is target surplus. And I'll hand back to Pete and he can go through this one.
Yeah, thanks, Gerard. So I'm going to talk through a little bit about, I guess, given the volatility in the book, if you don't want to reduce it, how can you deal with that volatility? So before I start on that, maybe a quick background as to the target surplus setting process and how that all came about. So you'd probably be familiar with the graph on the screen, which has been presented by APRA a number of times over the last couple of years. And it just shows how target surplus fits into the regulatory regime that they are dealing with. So we have the regulatory capital, the PCR, which sits as a margin above liabilities, and you're not allowed to breach that. So you need to set your target capital at some level above that so that you minimise the likelihood of breaching this PCR. The ICAP then deals with all capital, really from the liabilities upwards, but primarily with everything above regulatory capital. And the idea of that is to deal not only with the target surplus policy and approaches, but also what you are doing with your excess capital as well. So target surplus, we need it primarily to deal with new business strain. We want to make sure that we've got enough so that when market conditions change, both economic and non-economic, that we've got enough capital to make sure that we are still not breaching our regulatory capital requirements. And also there can be changes because of assumption changes that you're making in your book. So this kind of harks back a little bit to the panel discussion that they had at the end of yesterday. Ian Harper had a picture or a graph of the general insurance industry and how target capital, the capital that companies are holding in GI is about 1.8 times the regulatory requirement. I think in life insurance it's quite similar. It's a little bit lower. So if I recall Ian Lachlan's speech from last year's summit, I think it's about 1.6 or 1.7 for the life insurance market. So very similar again. This is essentially the reason why we're needing this, because we don't want to be breaching the regulatory capital requirements. So we did a bit of a survey around the companies that we've worked with a lot and had a look at the key different approaches for how target surplus is set in those companies. So there are three key approaches that are used. The first is to use a LAGIC style approach. So using the same, framework as is used to calculate regulatory capital, but with stronger margins applied. The second is a stress and scenario testing approach, which is very similar to how what you need to do for the ICAP report. And the third is, a much more traditional high level, we need X million dollars of capital. So to look at the pros and cons of each of them, the LAGIC approach is clearly going to give you a much, a quantitative answer, and it's, objective. However, as we saw with the regulatory requirements as well, this is going to give us a more volatile target surplus. So using this method is probably going to give you some woes at some points in time, because you will have, the same volatility that you have in your regulatory capital, you're also going to see in your target surplus. We've seen that this method has been much less common in the past, but as LAGIC has been implemented and bedded down, it's starting to gain some momentum in business. The stress and scenario testing approach is still, I would say, the least popular of the approaches that that we've seen in the market. It's clearly easier to understand because you can set, you can say, look, these are the scenarios that you're testing against, and that is more tangible to non-actuaries, particularly senior management. But of course, those scenarios themselves are subjective. The high-level asset allocation, of course, is much simpler, stable, but it can result in a much more inefficient capital allocation because you would tend to have a larger allocation to make sure that you're covering your regulatory capital. So what we've seen is some companies moving towards using a combined approach, and part of this is to deal with this volatility and uncertainty both in the setting of target surplus but also in the regulatory capital underneath it. So if you can combine two approaches, it's almost like a diversification approach where you can, the amount of target surplus that you need will be smoothed out by combining these approaches. And I think the common two to combine are the LAGIC approach and the high level asset allocation. And that's what we've seen across the market. So dealing with this volatility, we just spoke about how we could combine different methods of calculation of target surplus. One of the other approaches is to look at risk appetite. So, of course, the amount of volatility that you're willing to accept is a risk appetite, aspect. And most companies are trying to understand a bit better about how much volatility they are willing to deal with. And that's obviously a discussion that people are having currently, given that LAGIC has now been in for a year or so, and companies are kind of refining the ways in which they manage their business and their capital. Another approach is to have a look at the capital and consider that over a longer period of time. Of course, if you calculate your capital at each point in, you still need to make sure that you are meeting a capital requirement continuously. But taking a longer-term approach or almost like an averaging approach across your calculations can help to smooth and help management understand better how much capital is really required. So, for example, you may want to have a look at how the capital requirement has moved over the last 6 months or even potentially even longer in determining how much target surplus you need to hold. And that, I think, plays well to the approach where you have a combined calculation. So where you're using the LAGIC approach with stronger stresses and you also have a high-level dollar asset allocation, which you want to combine into a single measure. Using this averaging approach can help, particularly on the latter of those. And last but not least, of course, it's important to make sure that management understand both the changes that have happened and also how you're dealing with that, so that at each point in time, they can understand much better what the process is and why this extra volatility has come about. And how you are adequately dealing with it. So now I am going to hand back to Gerard, who's going to talk a bit more about the other side of the coin, which is, well, if you don't want to deal with the volatility that exists in it, what approaches do you have to reduce the existing volatility in the calculations?
So I guess the obvious one which comes to mind is closer asset liability matching, be it with physical assets or be it with derivatives. We've been having quite a lot of conversations with people on this topic, especially around the CPI. So people with quite big disabled lives reserves, maybe some companies with annuity books, or basically any type of liability with some kind of CPI linkage. And the question that comes to mind is the CPI swap market big enough and developed enough to cope with all these requirements. And talking to some of the banks, this is something they're quite keen to have discussions with insurers about, on how to develop the CPI hedging, particularly because, you know, the new standards pick up that risk much more sort of accurately than they weren't in the old standard. Explicit stresses on both sides. Likewise with normal duration hedging in any sort of product with duration, refining those interest rate hedges and making sure they move similarly and understanding the basis risk actually between that hedge and the liability side more accurately. I've seen a couple of cases overseas where people have actually put on so-called spread lock derivatives to try and eliminate that basis risk, but that's more for companies who are to sort of cutting a fine line in terms of how much capital they have, but at least understanding what the scale of that is. Working with the banks to refine hedges is definitely something I see happening. Asset allocation changes. I've seen a couple of examples of this where a company might say, I have a capital budget of X. What is the optimal asset strategy, the optimal mix of credit, mixture of credit and non-credit assets, so I get the best return on that capital. Doesn't need to be a big complicated sort of ALM optimization routine. It can be a selection of scenarios to illustrate the point. Because what's best in terms of meeting return targets is not necessarily the best in terms of capital requirements and the volatility of capital. To a lesser extent is probably revising your product mix to try and optimize how much diversification you're getting between different product lines. Are you overweight in one line simply because that's what sells the best? Does there need to be more focus on a different product line? And the last one, which is, I think, very important, when I've seen big changes in overseas, is the organizational structure. So typically what you had in the past, you had an ALM team doing something, calculating capital requirements. You had the asset, sort of the investment team managing the asset separately. You had a pricing team doing their job separately as well. So you had these silos and only occasional interaction between the three. Whereas with this type of risk-based capital regime and volatility it has and how it picks up the risks, there needs to be far closer interaction between the three. I've seen examples where actually you have one person who sort of oversees everything to do with that product line, be it pricing, be it the hedging, be it how the assets are managed. So, you know, so it brings everything under one umbrella, and that's some of the changes I've seen there. You can also, this is looking more at the risk function of the insurer. The last point there is rewarding behavior, which reports and controls the volatility where it's out of line with risk appetite. That we won't spend too long on this slide. It's just an illustration of how different the capital requirements can be depending on how you choose to hedge something. So I just picked some disability income contract, 5-year duration, where the inflation sensitivity gap between assets and liability is about 5 basis points, or 5 million per basis point, rather. And just at a very high level, under two possible strategies to deal with the inflation hedging. One is I remove my duration and I have a bunch of equity underlying it because the equity will provide real returns over time and expect to cover that inflation requirement. It generates a very large capital requirement of 46 million. Whereas if you use an alternative approach, you'd really focus on CPI swap hedging with any sort of credit, more AA credit strategy, it sort of comes down to roughly a tenth of the capital requirement. This is an extreme example. You wouldn't do a hedging strategy based on the first one, but it illustrates you can get big differences between how you choose to go about hedging these risks. So in this particular example, as I discussed before, we're seeing demand for CPI swap hedging increasing and closer attention being paid to interest rate hedging. But obviously, you know, there needs to be an understanding of the return on capital implications because the second strategy gives you a much lower return than the first. So it's a balance between the two. This just reiterates what I was saying earlier in terms of organizational design, how all the functions who run ALM pricing, asset management, and to an extent even reporting, because they will see the ultimate numbers coming through, all working together and much more linked up than we've seen. And the last area to talk about quickly is catalysts for further change to asset liability management. Particularly in Australia, there are very large superannuation lump sums accumulating, and that will have to go somewhere over the medium term. So there's an ageing population as well, an increasing life expectancy. So there's speculation that will we see more duration-type products, not necessarily a lifetime annuity, but sort of maybe more fixed-term type annuities, maybe variable annuities start to take off. We've seen bits and pieces in the market of people coming up with these sort of innovative retirement products, all which will have a duration aspect to them, meaning that demand for hedging and the types of issues we've talked about become more pertinent. I mean, if you look at the UK market, people would say the opposite, because they've just removed compulsion, so you don't have to buy a sort of any sort of annuity when you retire. And the current expectations are that volumes in that market will drop from sort of £12 billion per annum of premium to sort of £3 billion, so 75% odd reduction. Are we going to see the reverse of that in Australia? Who knows, but it's a possibility. And if indeed in the future you do get these more duration-style products, I'd expect to see the banks getting more involved in structuring derivatives to hedge some of that risk, particularly longevity, as we're seeing overseas. So I guess that's a quick trawl through a topic which is very big, looking at what does LAGIC require now. It's more volatile than it's been in the past. There are other risks, such as basis risk, which add to the volatility. What can you do about it? Do I set target surplus? Do I hedge better or change my asset allocation or review my hedging? And how could that change in the future? So thanks very much, and I'm sort of open to questions.
Is this on?
Yes. Thank you, Gerard and Peter. That's a really good and comprehensive presentation. We're open for questions now, but while people have a think, well, when they do have questions, if they can come up to the one of the microphones and say their name and just speak clearly. While people are quickly thinking, I'll just start with a question or two. Always interesting thinking about hedging, that hedging often doesn't eliminate risks, it just changes risks. So you get rid of some risks, but obviously start getting counterparty and potentially asset concentration risks and things. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's right, Richard. So a lot of the derivatives that are used, sort of inflation or interest rate-based derivatives, you would expect, especially after the GFC, to have, you know, sensible collateralization and over-collateralization arrangements in place. In a lot of the swap markets I've dealt with, you typically have, for the interest rate and inflation of swaps, you know, collateral based on either government bonds or cash. And sometimes what you have is over-collateralization, where if the market value of the swap is 100, collateral have to be posted to 101 or 102% of that value to protect you from that. But that risk is always there, the counterparty risk. That just mitigates it to an extent. And in terms of concentration risk, that's probably a very important one. especially there are examples where a company, you know, we mentioned asset cliffs earlier, or sort of cliffs in the requirement, where there's no capital requirement for a while and there's been a rally in a particular stock and it breaches the concentration limit and you suddenly have a chunky requirement for that bit becomes, you know, chargeable. So it's, it really, it, you can do all the hedging and so on. but there are, you know, mitigation actions you can take, which won't eliminate things perfectly, but you also need the control to kind of watch for some of these cliffs that get introduced by the way the standards work.
Yeah, I would have added to that as well that I guess under the, I guess it reinforces the need to look at the capital requirements or when you're making changes to the book to do it post-capital. So I guess I think historically there's been a lot of asset managers, or when you work with the asset managers, you typically look at the returns post-capital or pre-capital in some cases, and the actuaries would layer that their capital up on top. But I think it makes it much more important for the actuaries to work with the asset managers to understand what are the post-capital implications under a variety of scenarios that you're considering.
Yeah. Have we got any questions? Anyone on? I'll ask another then. Companies also have a choice. We were saying about setting objectives. You can set objectives to potentially minimise capital volatility or profit volatility, but not both. Have you got thoughts on that as to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think it needs to be a balance, really, between the two. This one's probably a bit fuzzy. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, in all these things, it needs to be a balance. You've got things you want to optimize, and you've got constraints around it. I think for some companies, capital volatility will be much more important because they sort of, as I say, you know, examples of where you're quite close to the limits, really. For others, that may not be as much of a concern. Willing to handle more volatility for, getting a bigger profit, basically. So I think it will vary company to company on how they balance those two. I don't know, Pete, have you got?
Another issue is when you're setting your investment policies is that your capital calculations are based on your actual assets, but when you're setting your investment policy, you tend to have a whole bunch of risk limits and things for the managers and things. So you need to be careful that your managers can't go to the extremes and send you insolvent.
I'd agree with that. It's a question around there's your asset mandate, which the managers will have limits and targets to achieve. But it's a question on how those are set in relation to the other side of the coin, which is the risk and capital requirements it generates, which the asset manager sometimes doesn't see, depending on how you're organized. So what you could actually do is redefine some of those limits in terms of capital consumption, which some companies are sort of ahead in the game and thinking that through. It's a change to what we've typically seen.
Any questions out there? Us, please.
Should why? Thanks for the presentation, Gerard and Peter. That was good. Just a question on... Hang on, I forgot my question. You mentioned a link between pricing and the ALM committee, and it worked well for some of the companies overseas. Could you elaborate a bit more on that? And further on another question, on potential asset classes that are capital efficient as well, given the LEGIC standards and what you have seen in the industry, has any particular asset class, like mortgages, for example, become a bit more attractive from a risk and return kind of with a trade-off?
Yeah. So to deal with the first part, linkage between pricing and ALM committees, I've really seen this in annuity business happening overseas, but it can equally be applied to any line that requires underlying assets to back the liability. And it's really when you're pricing, you look at, you know, the yields that you're going to be getting on your assets and how that will, you know, give you an appropriate return on capital. From the, so that's what the pricing team is really doing. But how that yield is comprised up of depends on exactly what the underlying assets are and what risks they entail and so on. So there needs to be, and that risk then will in turn determine what capital requirements you need. So to me it would seem that you need a close interaction between people who are pricing and using the yields and looking at return on capital and the people who are actually investing the money in different asset types. Rather than just saying, oh, we can get 7%, it gives this capital requirement, therefore I need to price at Y to get my return on capital. Saying, well, what's the optimal mix I need to get the 7% given the capital it needs? So it's an optimization process between actual investment of assets, yields, return, and the capital. Does that make sense, linking the two? Yeah. On this, what was the second part that was about which assets?
Just on that as well.
Yep.
What was the structure of the committee or the team that was looking after the ALM strategy? Did you have someone from pricing who was sitting within the
That could be one committee? Way of doing it. That's an interesting idea. What I've seen is one person who could be on that committee, for example, who has their eyes across several dimensions, so not just across one aspect, but would be looking at, you know, what is this business returning overall and what are the drivers of that return. There's another presentation, I think, that's on the list, which talks about how the actuarial function can change to be more value-adding to the business. This is one example of that, where you could have, you know, someone with their eyes just not on the reporting bit or on the ALM bit, or on, you know, outside the immediate day-to-day running on the asset management bit, but someone who's looking at all those aspects together at a higher level. Your last point on assets, we're not seeing a fundamental shift in how people, you know, allocate their assets at this stage. It's still relatively new. I have seen people looking more intensely at things like infrastructure and how that could be used. And a little bit more of an interest I've seen in mortgages, actually. So things like equity release type products, you know, what sort of, you know, how can they be used? Things like hedge funds as well. So there's a range that people are doing, but I haven't seen a wholesale change in the attitude yet. That could be further down the line.
So particularly, I guess, in terms of the way that the standards are calculated, or that you need to calculate capital via the standards, you know, equity obviously has a significant shock now compared to previously, and the other thing is the lower rated bonds. So again, it comes back down to, I guess, what are the current returns in the market, and actually calculating that risk return trade-off, because obviously that's always changing.
We probably have time for one more question.
Hayden Burno. Just wondering, in this more volatile regulatory capital environment and potentially target capital environment, whether what changes you've observed in the setting of the triggers below the target level for corrective action to be taken? Are there more triggers? Are there more severe corrective actions happening? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think it's a good time to have had the new standards, because companies are now getting to the point where they can now recalculate their capital on a much more frequent basis than previously. So I think the biggest change is that companies are just doing that analysis and reviewing it much more frequently than they previously did. That's probably the biggest change. I haven't seen a lot of people changing the actual triggers, but I'm not sure if you have, Gerard. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Sure.
I think we, as it beds in again over, we've had 1 year now, I guess, as we move forward, we might see people reviewing that. I think it's the sort of thing that's constantly under review as you go through different conditions. But it's something you'd potentially expect if people see a lot more volatility in their business. They will see, well, actually, maybe we need to shift the triggers.
Thank you. I think also risk-based capital. Yeah, we're going to squeeze in one more question.
Hi there, Ming Chen. Just a question on pro-cyclicality and counter-cyclicality of prudential capital as well as target capital. I noticed you mentioned that the prudential capital is now more sensitive to risks, and that I think is why you're seeing more volatility. One of the APRA's objectives when they introduced LAGIC was for the prudential capital to become less pro-cyclical, so when there is when there's downturn in markets, ideally you carry, you know, your capital buffer sort of is being used up, and therefore you have less capital. Are you seeing that in your calculations and your observations when you do the back tests? That's the first part of the question. And the second part of the question is, how do we then use that to, I guess, have more counter-cyclicality in the way we set target capital as well?
Yeah, so I'll comment and then you can comment a bit as well. The pro-cyclicality is sort of dealt with. So where you have very low, let's say, equity yields or whatever, the stress, you know, goes lower as well. So that effect does come through. But what it also does is it does, it partly contributes to the volatility. So under certain conditions, the stress is much lower. On other conditions, it gets much bigger. So it does move around quite a bit. But I think the approach to calculating the capital does help in to reduce pro-cyclicality in the way it is. So we do see that. I don't know if you...
Yeah. I think... I guess cyclicality, I guess, can be over time, whereas you can still have a volatile capital requirement from month to month or quarter to quarter. So I guess wanted to draw that distinction. Some of the other features they built into the new capital standards are limits on the stresses as well. So once you get up to once the stress, say, is higher, once the stress that you calculate that you need to apply is higher than 1 or 200 bips for some stresses, you'll cap it at that amount. So I guess that helps to reduce the cyclicality as well as the volatility.
Yeah. And then I think it depends on the target surplus point. It's again depends which of the various methods you're using. If you're using the first one, which is, you know, apply different stresses or set a probability of not breaching the PCA at a certain level and sort of more quanti type approach, that one you could see target surplus moving around in a similar way. If you're taking a different, a higher level approach or an approach which smooths it over time, you'd see less pro-cyclicality in with that approach. So it's target surplus, I think, is not one where you can categorically say one or the other. It depends on your approach. But that's a good question.
I love that excellent question. I think we've just about run out of time, so I'd like to thank Jared and Peter for a very good, very detailed and practical presentation, and can we thank them in the usual way?